Tonight we have an exciting first hour guest. It is Pat Summerall. Now, Pat Summerall is a legendary broadcaster. He has broadcast most of the major sports. He has called at least 26 or parts of 26 different Super Bowls. Played for the New York Giants and about 14 years ago went into recovery for his alcoholism. There was an intervention that was done on him that was spearheaded by his former broadcast partner, Tom Brookshire. He went to the Betty Ford Treatment Center, stayed sober for... well, he has stayed sober throughout, but 9 years into his sobriety, he had a knee replacement operation, and as a part of that, or some of the repercussions from that, he developed an infection that affected a number of organs in his body, including his liver. The bottom line was he needed a new liver. He continued to get sicker until he reached the top of the transplant list, eventually got a new liver from a 13-year-old boy from down in Arkansas. And as a result of that, he did make a full recovery. He is now a grateful recovering alcoholic. He'll share that experience with all of us in our first hour tonight. We're going to be talking to Pat Summerall. What a great career he has had. 45 years in broadcasting. He has broadcast all or part of 26 Super Bowls, covered every major sporting event, has worked for CBS, Fox, and ESPN, recently celebrating his 76th birthday and is still going strong with the liver of a 13-year-old young man. He went into treatment for alcoholism back in 1992 at the Betty Ford Treatment Center following the 1992 Masters Tournament and an intervention that basically turned his life around. It was in Augusta that he looked into the mirror in a guest house and saw what others were seeing. He's been in recovery for 14 years, had knee replacement surgery back in 2000. A year later, following some dental work and forgetting to take some antibiotics, infection invaded his body. It taxed the organs, especially the liver. His health worsened to the point where he rose to the top of the transplant list, not because of his name or his stature, but because he had the worst liver in the country and was the closest to death. April 10th, 2004, he had a highly successful liver transplant, receiving the gift of life from a young 13-year-old boy, Adrian Shelby, from Arkansas. After his physical recovery from the transplant, combined with his ongoing recovery from alcoholism, his increasing faith in God and love of Jesus Christ, and the miracles granted to him. He's written a riveting memoir called On and Off the Air, published by Thomas Nelson Books, and we are delighted tonight to welcome broadcasting legend Pat Summerall. Good evening, Pat. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm just absolutely delighted to be able to talk to you tonight. I recently emceed a day-long celebration of sobriety for National Alcohol and Drug Recovery Month and talked about the importance of putting a face and a voice on recovery. And I held up your book, Pat, and told people that if you want to see the face of recovery, the joy, the grace, the wonder, and the miracle, just look at the face of the man on the cover of this book. One picture is worth a thousand words, and it certainly epitomizes the joy of recovery. And even if you don't buy the book, which, by the way, I highly recommend that you do because it's a great read, at least take a few minutes to look into the face of recovery. Pat, the book is an incredible roller coaster ride from the heights of success on that national stage to the doors of death, bloated to up to 300 pounds and given just hours to live. You were truly touched, Pat. Make that embraced by the loving arms of God. How are you today? What are you doing today?
I feel better. First, to answer the question, that I feel better than I felt since I was in my teens almost. I can't tell you how good I feel and how good my help is. And what I'm doing is trying to spread the word about how recovery is, how an association and an acceptance from the church is, from Christ, being accepted into God's family. I'm doing what I can to spread that word and tell how great recovery is, and to say thank you for the blessing I received in that liver transplant.
We have a number of emails in anticipation of your visit tonight from around the country that we're going to get to. And of course, my bias also being in the sports business, working for Fox Sports Radio and Sirius and ESPN, is to gravitate towards sports. But I want to stay away from that in this interview, except for the first question, which came from Chris in Kirkland, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is we have a flagship station that we broadcast on. We've been on the air almost a year now. But we are also in streaming audio, and we are all over the country, all over the world, as a matter of fact, and we receive emails from all over the country. And so the technology has changed considerably. The landscape in radio has changed. And the question from Chris is, how has the technology changed from the time that you began broadcasting football games up until now?
Well, when I first began, there was no such thing as instant replay. There was no isolated camera. I think the main change, other than the technicalities and the graphics that we have the ability to put on the screen now, is the mobility of the equipment. And when I began broadcasting, there were usually five cameras on a game. They were stationary. They were too big and too bulky to move around. So you didn't have the mobility that you have today. So the way games are covered now gives you so many more vantage points, so much more access to more information. The mobility of the equipment, I think, is the big change to me.
You know, it was interesting in covering the Giants-Seahawks game to watch that camera that they've got on the wires that go all across the field. It's like a robot. It's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah. And the pictures you get from that camera are amazing.
In the book, you talk about prior to instant replay, being on the sidelines, taking Polaroid pictures as a precursor to instant replay.
Right. I was actually in a room underneath Yankee Stadium with a Polaroid camera, taking pictures of the television sets that were in the available in that room. And we'd isolate, they would isolate one of the cameras on a particular individual, and I'd take a photograph, a Polaroid photograph of that isolated picture and take it back to the director in the control truck. That was the beginning, really, of instant replay, the isolated camera, the replays that we have today. That was really the beginning. That's how it all got started.
Visiting with Pat Summerall, the book is called On and Off the Air by Thomas Publishers, available certainly online and at all great bookstores around this country. An email coming in from Jim from Worcester, Massachusetts. Pat, when did you first realize that you had a drinking problem?
Oh, I think at the intervention, people had told me, a number of people, executives at CBS and another people, number of people that work with me on a daily basis, had said to me, why don't you slow down a little bit? People are watching you. We think you're drinking too much, but I just didn't take any heed. I thought that whatever, if there was a problem, I could manage it myself. And then there was an intervention, and in which there were 15 people who read letters to me that they had written, people that I respected and in some cases feared even, because of their business positions. And they told me of things that they had seen me do and things that they thought I would be ashamed of, and they were indeed right. And thank goodness I listened to them. They said they had a plane waiting for me to take me to the Betty Ford Clinic in Palm Springs. And if I would go for treatment, and I thank goodness I accepted the invitation or the demand, and that saved my life because I did go.
Tom Brookshire was involved in that intervention.
Right,
he
was.
Yeah. And you went into there thinking you were going into a meeting, and there you find these 15 people
right.
who love and care for you.
Right.
And you go there, but upon arriving at Betty Ford, some of the anger starts setting in.
Well, I was angry at the initial meeting. I was angry at a lot of the people who were there because I thought, these guys, what are they doing telling me what to do? Because they have more problems than I do. I didn't realize at the time that they were trying to help, that they were befriending me. And so I was bitter about that and angry about that. And it took me a while to get over that anger.
An email from Sandra in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. How has your relationships changed with those who were your drinking buddies back then?
Well, the people that were drinking buddies were in some cases good friends. And those people who fit into that category are still very close and very good friends. The drinking buddies who were just drinking buddies, I don't know where they are or what's happened to them. They've dropped me, and I have new friends, and I remember our acquaintances and what we did in those days, but I don't ever see the people again. So the true friends are still true friends. The drinking buddies are no longer around.
What was your treatment experience like at Betty Ford?
Well, in the beginning, as I said, they kept me 5 extra days because I was so angry. So I really didn't hear much of what was said, or I didn't absorb much of what the teaching was about for the first 5 days. And after that anger started to subside and I started to forgive a few people, I started to listen to what the recovery people said. And thank goodness I did, because that saved my life. The treatment itself, at first I thought, this doesn't apply to me. I don't want to listen to this. And then as I began to realize that it did apply to me and that I could get some help from a higher power, Then it started to help, and then the messages started to be accepted in my mind, and I accepted that there was a higher power and that there was indeed a source of power for me to tap.
Albert in San Diego writes, wants to know, once you left treatment, was there ever a relapse, and how do you deal with the compulsion to drink?
Well, I've been very fortunate in that area. No, there's never been a relapse. I haven't had a drink since I left the doors of the Betty Ford Center. And I have had no craving. I've been very fortunate from what I hear of talking to other alcoholics. I've been very fortunate in that I never had a craving. I've never wanted another drink. I've never wanted to go back to that atmosphere. So I've been blessed in that area.
You had to make, obviously, significant changes upon leaving treatment, and you dealt in the book, and the book, by the way, is called On and Off the Air by Pat Summerall. You dealt very tenderly and very lovingly with a decision that you made coming out of treatment in terms of your marriage.
Well, I wanted to go back. I wanted to make it work. I went back, and I sincerely tried. But I had done so much damage, not only to my wife, with my conduct, but to my kids as well. And I legitimately tried very hard to make it work, but it just, she couldn't find it in her heart to forgive me, and I just couldn't put the pieces back together. I tried very hard.
And there was another piece of that, Pat, and that was a love that you had for Sherry.
Yeah, I had met Sherry, to whom I'm married now. I met her. And we had a tenderness, we had a relationship that couldn't be replaced. I just couldn't get that relationship out of my heart. And thank goodness I didn't.
An email from Jennifer in Albany, New York. Was there negative reaction for people who found out that you were getting a liver after being an alcoholic?
Not so much. I don't think I had a tough time justifying it in my own mind. That I was getting another chance, that I was getting an organ from somebody who had to die, for me to live. I had lived a long and full and tough life in some cases. And there was some thought, some doubt in my own mind if I deserved a chance for another liver, for another life. And that was answered, I think, in largely by two people who were standing at the foot of my bed after the operation was a success. And I asked these two preachers, these two ministers who were standing at the foot of the bed, if they felt, or why did they feel I deserved another chance? And they both said, as if they'd practiced the answer together in unison, they said, because God's not through with you yet. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness he's not. Thank goodness he wasn't. Because that's what I've been trying to do since I got the liver transplant.
Sylvie in Phoenix writes, wants to know who is the most important person to you in your recovery and why?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I suppose I'd have to say my acceptance of Christ and his welcoming me into his family and my saying to him, come into my family, that's by far the most important step that I made.
An email from Thomas T. from Big D, assuming that's Dallas. You were acquainted with former Governor Ann Richards. What thoughts do you have on her openness about her alcoholism and her eventual recovery and some thoughts on her passing?
Well, she was a dynamic human being. She and I spent time together. We discussed it together. And I felt the same way about her to openly discussing it that I talked to Mrs. Ford, to the president's wife, when I was at the clinic. And it was supposed to be anonymous. Nobody was supposed to know that I was there. Alcoholism is supposed to be AA is called Alcoholics Anonymous, of course you know. But I said to her, what would have happened if you had stayed anonymous, if you hadn't made public the knowledge that you were an alcoholic, and there would be no Betty Ford Center, there would be no recovery program like that. And I just thought the more people that knew about the problems that I had, the more chance I had to help people. And certainly Mrs. Ford agreed with me that if she had stayed private with her problems, there would be no Betty Ford Center and there would be no place to go for help.
Stephen Providence has written in. He wants to know, how has being a celebrity in recovery helped others? Have people with addiction problems called you for help, knowing that you are, in fact, successful in your recovery?
Every time I walk through an airport, every time I'm at a stadium, Every time I'm at a public event, people come to me and say, we have a friend in common. And when I say who, they say, you know who. They say Bill W. And they ask, they tell me that they're searching. They need help. What can I do? Or else they're in recovery. And they want me to know that they're sharing the same problems that I had. So, yes, it's helped greatly, I think. And for me to go public and me to be willing to discuss it, I think is certainly had a profound effect. It's great therapy for me.
Samuel in Fargo, North Dakota, what was your relationship like with your family while you were drinking and now that you are in recovery?
Well, thank goodness my kids, my late wife is dead. She just passed away last December. We had a cordial relationship. It was terrible during the time I was drinking. My relations with my three children was terrible during the time I was drinking. I lost them. I became the villain, as often happens in a divorce proceeding. Since then, since I've exhibited the faith that I have to them, and they've seen how strong it is, they have reaccepted me as a father, as I think I said in the preface in the book. But the relationships we have now are irreplaceable. They're so good, and we are so close. I'm just sorry that I did all the damage I did when I did it. It was a terrible time for me and for them.
But now recovery, I assume it keeps getting better.
Yes, it does.
And are you out on the speaking tour now? Are you doing any broadcasting?
Yes, I've been on a book tour and speaking tour for the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I've been all over the East Coast and in various other places.
Do you miss the national spotlight in terms of broadcasting?
Well, to a degree, I'm still in the national spotlight, but I don't miss the spotlight part of it. I miss the being involved in the events and the preparation and the associations and the friends that I made while I was in broadcasting and playing in the NFL. I miss that. I don't miss the traveling, but the other part of it I do miss.
Jillian in Miami, Florida, what advice can you give a family member whose loved one is dying from the disease and refuses to seek help? It's my dad, and I know he's going to die if he doesn't get help.
I wish I could answer that question. I think until your dad or anyone realizes that they have a problem and they realize that there is help, but I think the toughest person to be honest with, I know the toughest person for an individual to be honest with is themselves. And until you realize and admit that you do have a problem, no amount of counseling and no amount of consultation is going to help until you accept the fact that, hey, I've got a problem and I am an alcoholic and I need somebody to help me.
What about intervention? Obviously, that helped for you.
Oh, it saved my life. Intervention is a possibility if the individual is willing to accept that help and that love.
And it boils down to you know, getting that person to make that choice and to go into treatment.
Right.
And, you know, they say you can't lead a horse to water, but you can make him drink. You can get someone into treatment and then let the process begin. Pat, why now? Why did you write the book at this point?
Well, I thought people had said to me when I was sitting around or we were at parties or gatherings anywhere, people had said to me for a long time, my gosh, you've got so many memories, you've met so many people. People would like to hear if you would share some of those stories. And I just felt, in the beginning, I felt, number one, I didn't want to embarrass myself with some of those stories. I didn't want to embarrass anybody else. I didn't want to write a tell-all book. So I really waited until now, until I had been through recovery. I had been through some things in my life. I had been through the liver transplant, and I had another chance at life. And I thought maybe if I shared those experiences with somebody, it might help somebody. So I wanted to write a book, but I wanted to wait until I felt I had something constructive to say. So that's why.
An email coming in from Big Al in Philadelphia wants to know, what is the best thing that you learned while in treatment?
Oh, I think the best thing, without question, was there was a higher power and that I could accept a higher power. In my case, it was Jesus Christ. It was faith in the Lord. There's nothing that gets any higher than that. There's nothing that's any better than that. Just the realization that what was happening to me and what had happened to me wasn't all my responsibility. There was somebody who was guiding me in my life. I wasn't the boss, that there was a higher power.
Jamal in Roanoke, Virginia, being a celebrity, how difficult is it for you to stand up and say, my name is Pat Summerall and I'm an alcoholic?
In the beginning, it was very difficult. I have friends who've been through programs, who've reached the point of recovery, who still can't stand up in front of a group of people and say, hey, my name is Pat Summerall and I'm an alcoholic, or whatever their name is. It was very difficult in the beginning. But now, the more you say it, the more I stand up in front of a group of people, and they answer me back after I say my name's Pat Summerall and I'm an alcoholic. It has become less and less difficult.
Jerry in Norman, Oklahoma, is it difficult to be around people who drink, and does your family or does your wife drink?
No, my wife does not. She quit the same day I did. She hadn't had a drink like me in 14 and a half years. And it doesn't bother me to be around people that drink. I don't have a craving. I see what happens to them. I wish I could go, and I can on occasion if they ask, how do you do it? How do you quit drinking? If they don't ask, I don't intrude on their lives. It's up to them. And it's up to them to make a choice not to do it. But no, it does not bother me.
Stephen in Bakersfield, California has written on an email, did you use other drugs besides alcohol, and did you ever get arrested?
No. In both cases, the answer is no.
Okay. Anthony in Grandview, Missouri, how difficult is it to be a celebrity in recovery with all eyes watching you, some just waiting for you to relapse?
Well, when I first got out of the Betty Ford Center, I was at the Palm Springs Airport. I was sitting. I had a craving for ice cream while I was in the recovery center. So I got an ice cream cone, and I was sitting on a ledge in the Palm Springs Airport. And a gentleman came over to me who recognized me, and he said, he didn't say congratulations. He didn't say anything other than, I know who you are. And he said, his question was, do you think CBS is going to hire an old drunk back again? And it was a shock for him to say that, and I wondered at that time, is that going to be the way it is? Am I ever going to laugh again? Am I going to have any friends? What's life going to be like now? It's not going to be the fun thing that it was before. But I discovered that life is a lot better now. It's more fun now. I remember everything that happens. The stories aren't nearly as funny as they used to be, but we still tell them. Those friends I have who were true friends, we still get together. So life has been very gratifying. I have no complaints. It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
You talk about laughter and funny stories. Towards the end of your book, after the liver transplant, you went through some problems psychologically, probably as a result of the medication, where you turned into bad Pat. It was good Pat and bad Pat.
Mm.
And you had a funny line about losing your lips and how you could you possibly continue as a broadcaster when you don't have any lips. And, you know, it's probably bizarre, and I probably have a sick sense of humor, but I just absolutely roared when I read that. Talk about that period, though. It wasn't
well,
really funny.
Well, I don't remember too much about that.
Yeah.
That mostly was told to me by my wife, who was there faithfully, and my kids who were with me. The whole time. I did some things that they couldn't believe and I couldn't believe. I thought I was not only losing my lips, I lost my ears, and I don't remember too much about it because that's something that I think is fairly common for somebody who's been without sleep and in what they call psychotic ICU. Mm. That's what they call it. I don't have any idea what it means. But most of that stuff I don't remember, so whatever information you get about that, you'll have to ask from them.
Yeah, and it's chronicled in the book, and there was one point where you were cutting your hair off and trying to look like Bruce Willis and doing some crazy things. How long did that period last, Pat?
I don't know. I can't answer that. You'll have to ask my wife and my kids.
But you did come out of it, and then the long healing began.
Right.
Talk about the importance of organ donation. I definitely want to get that in before we finish up the interview.
Well, you're saving somebody's life. Someone saved my life. You have the thing it's hard to justify. It was hard for me to justify. It was what I said a minute ago. Why does somebody have to die in order for me to live? But that, unfortunately, is the case. The person, of course, who donates has no recollection of it. It's such a humane thing to do. I can't tell you how much I've been involved in organizations that encourage organ donation. And it's such a gift of life. That's all it is. And that's what it's called in many, many cases. There's a house in Rochester, Minnesota, where I visited, called the Gift of Life. And it's a house where those who are donors or recipients, their families go and they can stay in a family atmosphere during that period of time, which is difficult to accept, but also one of the most gracious things you could possibly ever do, that is to donate an organ.
Frank, in New Orleans, I have been in and out of AA for 10 years. I get a few months one day at a time, then I had 2 years, but I always seem to go back out. Sometimes I think I start drinking when things start going well, and then I can't handle the success of my sobriety. Is there a key to long-term sobriety?
I don't know if there's a key or not. It has not been a problem for me because I've never had that craving. I never wanted to. I never thought about relapsing. So I think I'm blessed in that area, but I think until you realize, as I said before, until you admit to yourself that you have a serious problem and the place to go for help is some higher power, until you make that admission to yourself that you can't handle it by yourself, then I don't think you can ever completely recover.
We have an email from Jillian in Bangor, Maine. Pat, how important is spirituality in your recovery?
Well, until I made the admission that I couldn't handle what I was doing to myself by myself, the admission that there was a higher power, that I could get, and if I accepted help from Christ, if I admitted to myself that I couldn't do it by myself, spirituality, I can't tell you how important it is. I couldn't have done it without an acceptance of Christ.
Jack, in Chicago, did you ever meet the family of the donor? And if so, what was that like?
Yes, I did. It was a long time. There was a procedure that you go through where you as the recipient, write a letter to the family of the donor, not telling who you are, not saying anything about what you do, not saying even where you live or how old you are, anything about yourself, but just talk about the things that you would have missed if you hadn't received the organ, and how grateful you are. And it's an anonymous letter. I wrote it back to the Mayo Clinic. They, in turn, saw that the family of the donor received it. And in the beginning, they did not want to meet me. But then as time passed and their heartache continued, I guess they did reach a decision among themselves, the husband, the wife, the mother, and they had another son. And we made it through an outfit that does such things in Little Rock, Arkansas. They arranged a meeting, and it was my wife and me and the three members of their family. And it was one of the most emotional things that's ever happened to me. There were a lot of tears, you can imagine. She grabbed me and hugged me and said, "I feel like I'm hugging my son." It was just one of the most emotional things, and I didn't know what to say. I was almost speechless. I've prepared for all these major events that I've done in my career, but I couldn't prepare for that meeting. I didn't know what to say.
And you continue to honor that young man today as you continue in your recovery.
Yes.
And he was 13 years old. And how did he pass away, Pat?
Of a brain aneurysm at the age of 13.
And how close to death were you before that liver became available?
I did not. I didn't know. The doctor, the surgeon who did the surgery, told me after the operation was a success that I had about 18 hours.
18 hours.
Right.
Another, obviously, a miracle from God.
Right.
And as you, there would be people who would say, well, he got a liver because he was Pat Summerall. Talk a little bit about how that process works and the fact that it really is anonymous and has nothing to do with your stature.
That's exactly right. A lot of people have that impression that because because I was who I was. I got moved up in the Oregon line, if that's the correct expression. But you have to be, there's a program, there's a list, there are 80,000 people in the country waiting for liver transplants, or waiting for transplants, not necessarily just liver. But you have to reach a degree of sickness, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You have to reach a certain level of need before you're ever put on their waiting list. And I was fortunate enough to be on the list. I went to the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, where the transplant was done. They determined that I was sick enough, and so they put me on their list. And I had no idea until they called and said, you have to be here in 4 hours. I live in Dallas, so we had to get there as quickly as we could. We went by air ambulance. But if I hadn't gotten there and hadn't gotten the treatment at the Mayo Clinic, I would not be talking to you today.
Another person who went through a similar situation, both in terms of addiction, recovery, and liver transplant, was your good friend Mickey Mantle.
Right.
Talk a little bit about him and about what happened in his situation.
Well, Mickey and I played a lot of golf together. We were very close friends. And after I went to the Betty Ford Center, he obviously saw the change that took place in me. We were no longer drinking buddies. We were just good friends. And so he started to ask me questions about what it was like, what recovery was like, what it was like at the Betty Ford Center. And I knew, although he didn't want to admit it, I knew from the beginning that he was asking me more and more about recovery and more about what went on at the Betty Ford Center. And finally, one day, he asked me if I thought I could get him into the center, and I did, through some friends that I had made there. I got him a bed at the Betty Ford Center, and it worked for him. For the last 18 months, he didn't have another drink, but he had done so much damage. In fact, he got a liver transplant, which was successful, but he had already, they discovered while they were making the liver transplant, I believe, that he already had cancer, and it just continued to spread. So he only lived 18 months, but for the last 18 months, after he had the transplant and after he became sober again, and after he no longer was an alcoholic. He didn't have a drink for the last 18 months that he lived.
How long does a transplanted liver last, and do you still take medication to prevent rejection?
Yes, I do. I still take medication. I hope it lasts for a long time. Nobody has told me it doesn't. So as long as I take care of myself and the liver and take the anti-rejection drugs, I think it's 13 years old. Now it's 15.
So you are, in many sense, many respects, a teenager as a result
of
that. A bionic teenager. And life for Pat Summerall is pretty darn good today, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and are you continuing to speak to groups around the country, alcoholism groups?
Yes,
And all of that?
Yeah.
Sharing your experience, strength,
right,
and hope.
Indeed.
And the book, again, is On and Off the Air, Pat Summerall. The front cover is a picture of Pat. And, again, if you look into the face of Pat Summerall, you're looking into the face of recovery. The former NFL commissioner, Paul Tagliabue, it's hard for me to say former, but that's the case now, says Pat Summerall's remarkable take is a great success story that includes all the ups and downs of real life. And I will conclude the interview by sharing the final passage on the last page of the book. "'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed." Pat, you are an amazing man. You're a great ambassador for recovery. And when people hear you, when they see you, it brings inspiration into their lives. And you continue to save lives one day at a time, one alcoholic at a time. In behalf of all the listeners who listen to Recovery Coast to Coast, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for that.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.